You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Excited to introduce to you Belle Tyndall Riley, who has written this book, which, hang on, you will be able to find in the bookshop, and you can also get it signed after this event. So please do that. It's called The Sacred Ache, and the subtitle is A Christian Perspective on the Search for Divinity in Witchcraft, Crystals, and Tarot, which sounds very exciting. And I am definitely looking forward to finding out more. And this is being chaired by vicar, radio host, and Greenbelt legend, Kate Botley, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with.
Hello, lovely humans.
I'll hand right over to her.
Thank you so much. Thank you ever so much. And thank you to everyone who makes this venue work and the sound people and all that sort of stuff. Thanks for what you do. Always worth remembering, eh? Just a minute, we're having our photo taken.
Yeah, the people need to see that, even if it's just for 2 minutes.
Look clever.
Yeah. Does this... Let me sort my posture out. 1 second. There you go. We're good.
Oh, get the book in. There we go. Perfect. Right, we'll stop messing about now.
You're a pro, I can tell.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm just an attention seeker. It's terrible. So it's lovely to welcome you to Greenbelt.
Hi.
Tell us about your Greenbelt story.
This is the first page of my Greenbelt story.
Wow!
This is my first time here. So I'm just soaking it all in, right. Learning everything about it.
And what have you been here all day? Have you
sadly we got very lost.
Yeah.
And so arrived much later than we were intending to.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I'm soaking it all up.
Well, we're really happy to have you, and this book, I've read the book and it's right up our street, Greenbelt. All right. This is right up our alley. Tell us about yourself and your faith journey and who you are and how you find yourself to be writing this book.
Sure. That's a great and big mahoosive question.
Just go.
I'll just ramble.
I'll put
and
sixpence
then...
in the meter.
Yeah.
Off you go.
Just give me like a kick if it gets boring. I'm originally from West Wales, Pembrokeshire in West Wales. You're all just silhouettes to me, but hello to those people. We could be related. It's a small town. We could be related for all we know. And I grew up there. I am the oldest of 5 siblings. My parents had 5 children in 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good going.
I know. And I say that because I do think the eldest daughter is my personality type. So it's like a shorthand to explain who I am and why I am the way I am. I'm the oldest of 5 siblings. And then that makes everything make sense. And amazingly, I suppose my faith journey, I have one of these amazing stories that I never thought was amazing. I thought was super dull, but that starts before even I do, if you know what I mean. Because I was born into a Christian family. And it's kind of a cool story, actually. My parents, they met when they were teenagers. It's a very small town story. They live 2 doors down from each other. And they started dating, and I think my mum was 15 and my dad was just a few years older. And my mum was a Christian and from a Christian family, and my dad just absolutely not at all. Like, all of that was like a whole new world to him. And so as they were dating, it's not that my mum ever stopped believing in God, but he definitely moved down the totem pole of priority, if that makes sense. And she tells this story, and then they got married because they wanted to she wanted to go with him to uni, and she was like, the only way my parents are going to let me do this is if I marry him. So she married him at the age of 19, and they went to Bristol together. And then she tells this story again, like God was just way down her list of things that she kind of like gave her time to, let's say. And she tells this story where she just felt like God kind of say to her when she found out she was pregnant with me, like, are you really going to have this baby without me? Are you really going to do this without me? And obviously that wasn't just about me. That was about the other 4 that were going to come after me. But I love that in a way my story starts there while I was still growing eyeballs. You know, that's where it starts for me. And so I grew up in a Christian family, and I loved God imperfectly, chaotically, very clumsily every day of my life, but I've always been horrifically embarrassed about that.
You tell a story about school right early on in the book, don't you?
Yes.
About being embarrassed about that.
Yes. This is one of my most core memories of childhood, right? I was in primary school I must have been maybe like 6 or 7 years old, tops. So we're talking like infants. And it was home time. And so in my head, it's so romanticized because I can like see my mum and the sun is shining down on her through the school gates. And I'm like running to her. And it's all very romanticized. And this boy who was in my class, Jake Gwillam, for those who are wondering.
You never forget their names, do you?
You never forget their names. This boy who was in my class, he just came up to me and it was so innocent and so matter of fact, but he just asked, Belle, do you and your family go to church? And I have no idea why, like I had no idea why, let's say, but something within me blurted out an instinctive and immediate no. Like an absolute denial just like vomited out of me. And unfortunately for me, I was stood next to my cousin who's just always been a better person than I am. And so my six-year-old cousin was like, yes, we do. And I wanted the ground to swallow me up. And I realized that I have not stopped living in that instinctive and immediate no for like my whole life. That still like bubbles out of me. And I do think that part of that is my personality. I am many things, but probably one of the worst things that I am is a chronic people pleaser. Like, it's quite trendy to call yourself a people pleaser now, but I'm like, no, you don't. Unless it's to a debilitating degree. A debilitating degree, that's not people pleasing. You don't understand what you're talking about. Like, it's a toxic trait within me. And so I do know that part of it is just my personality. It's who I am. There was something about the way this boy asked this question that made me think he doesn't want me to say yes, and therefore I won't. I will bend myself out of shape to be what this little boy wants me to be. And that's a trait that's followed me my whole life. Go on.
No, keep going.
But also I think there was, right, so I turned 30 earlier this month, and thanks, it came from, I'm not even joking, right, I turned 30 and in that exact week I got my first grey hair and I got excited that Strictly was starting next month. Like, it came for me so hard. So
garden centre vouchers for Christmas is, yes, just a hair's breadth, yeah, away.
I started shopping for bathroom tiles, yeah, like
that happens,
it just all happened.
Do your knees hurt yet?
Sorry?
Do your knees hurt yet?
Yeah, always. Yeah. Dodgy hips.
Yeah, that's gonna happen.
Anyway, so all of that to say that I was a child in like the early noughties, and many of us will remember that like topping the literary charts in the early noughties were books called The God Delusion, and The End of Faith, and God's Not Great, Why Religion Poisons Everything. And so now listen, I was in West Wales and I was 6 years old. I wasn't like overtly aware that this was the cultural air I was breathing in, but I must have somehow been like subconsciously aware that to be religious in that moment in time was like
was
social
an embarrassing
suicide.
Thing.
Was an embarrassing. It was literally delusional.
Yeah.
So it made me feel incredibly unintelligent. And yeah, so that, and my nervous system, if I'm being really honest, is still in that place, I think.
So your faith story up to the age, around that time, this kind of like embarrassment about believing,
yeah.
And you still got echoes of that now, but
huge.
You've written a book about believing in God,
well,
from a Christian perspective.
I know,
so
I'm
quite clearly you still
punishment.
Do believe in God.
Yeah, totally.
Right, okay, tell us about that then.
Yeah, so I still do. This is the thing, I'm still in that exact same place. It's just that my biggest secret all of a sudden became Googleable, and now what do I do? I've just got to die to myself every day. I've got to die to this little six-year-old part of myself that still, I don't know, is worried people will laugh at me or that people will still say I'm delusional or whatever.
So why has the six-year-old written this book then?
Yeah.
Why has the six-year-old started asking questions about the other kind of language we use around,
sure,
spirituality and religion and belief?
Yeah. So I think the cultural era shifted. I don't think today you would ever see a book top in the charts called The God Delusion. The cultural era shifted. I don't think we're as disenchanted now as we were. I don't think we're as in love with like staunch materialism and really like aggressive rationalism. I just think the cultural era has changed. And so
that sounds really hopeful.
I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I I want a re-enchanted world. That feels like healthier soil to me. That feels like truer soil to me. And so I started noticing that. I started noticing that there was this shift that was happening, and I didn't really have language or explanation for it. It was just like, something's changing here. And then I went to Glastonbury Music Festival for the first time.
When was this?
This was only in 2024. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I sound like a cliche. I went to Glastonbury and it changed my life, and I wrote a book about it. And but I went for the first time, and it felt like such a weirdly, I don't know, coming of age thing, because I remember growing up, obviously, Glastonbury's like extortioner. And so my parents were never taking five kids to Glastonbury, as if. But my dad used to put it on outside in our garden, and we all used to stand outside and just pretend we were there and while watching it on the BBC. And so to actually be there, I was like, oh my goodness. And I just noticed so much about the place. I noticed that as soon as you rock up, there's this zinginess, this like zingy energy. And that could be down to so many things. That could be down to the fact that it's such pure escapism. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you guys know, because this probably offers so much of the same stuff, this place, this beautiful place, like the escapism is so rich, where you really do feel like you've pressed pause on the mundanity of your life, and that you've gathered with thousands of other people that are doing the same. And it kind of starts to feel a bit like a pilgrimage you're all taking.
People often call Green Belt home. They call, yes, it like their spiritual home. It feels like coming home.
Yes.
And I think Glastonbury's certainly got a similar flavour.
It definitely does. People can't help but talk about it in spiritual terms, like to the point where maybe it makes people roll their eyes, because it's like, come on, it's not really heaven on earth. It's a field in Somerset. But, you know,
that's with lots of people with trust funds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But people can't help but reach for that kind of spiritual language to try and describe what the place is giving them. And so it's like subtly in the air everywhere, and there's social activism, and there's all this kind of emotional collective processing, and there's like this sense of belonging that all of that forges.
And there's the healing fields.
And then there's the healing fields. Yeah. So then there's this whole section of the site that's called the healing fields. Well, that language already is interesting, right? That a so-called secular music festival is offering a whole corner of it that's offering healing to people. And in that field, you have every single spiritual experience you could possibly imagine or dream up. Like, everything is on offer in that place. It is a marketplace of spiritual offerings and ideas and experiences. Everything is there. And so I was like, whoa, I have never seen anything like this in my, like, I'm from West Wales, rural West Wales. I was like, I've never seen anything like this.
And at the risk of sounding like your therapist, how did that make you feel?
Well, this is the funny thing. This is where it gets a bit, this is where it got interesting for me, because my, if I can be really vulnerable with you, Greenbelt, my default, I think, at seeing that at the first time would have been to either freak out and be like, my gosh, what is this? Get me out of this field. Or to dismiss it and kind of roll my eyes at it. I think that would have been my default. But right there, when I was stood in the middle of that festival and it's teeming with people, like, you can't get anywhere near some of the tents. People are queuing for hours. And when you remember that Shania Twain is on like 200 feet to your left, why are you queuing 45 minutes for this? It just all becomes so fascinating.
And would it be fair to say that your, I'm going to use the term, your sort of churchmanship, your background is a kind of evangelical kind of framework, like a, you know, sort of in out kind,
yeah,
of. So to find yourself in that place.
Yeah, totally.
Where it's a bit spiritually woo-woo. That's not a technical academic term, by the way.
I like it. I'm sure
it's a bit spiritual woo-woo.
Spiritually woo-woo.
And you're not usually from that kind of place.
Oh my gosh, no.
Did you feel a little bit, were you scared? Uncertain?
Yeah, totally. All of the above. Yeah, I mean, my background is an absolute mosaic of traditions. I don't fit neatly into one box. I'm
welcome to Greenbelt.
Yeah. I am all sorts. I am and have been all sorts of things, finding myself in all kinds of communities and churches and kind of like taking bits. But to be honest, I was like, whoa, what is this? And I felt this thought that sort of popped into my mind, and it felt, I don't know if any of you feel this, if any of you are Christians and you just have like this like thought that pops into your head and you think that just sounds too wise to be one of mine. Or what's more common for me is that sounds a little too selfless to be something I would think. That doesn't have enough me in it for that to be a thought that I generated. And I've come to be curious enough to just ask God, like, was that you? Was that you speaking to me? And I had one of those where I just felt like this thought that was like, just don't dismiss and don't demonize right now. Just for a second.
I like that. Don't dismiss and don't demonize.
Just don't dismiss, like two ends of the spectrum, right? Like don't roll your eyes and don't freak out. Don't dismiss and don't demonize right now. Just wait. And so I was like, okay, kind of reacting to, you know, what I've come to learn as the voice of God. And I was like, okay, so I was just there. And then another thing came into my mind, and it was this quote, and it flooded my mind. And it was from St. Augustine, Augustine of Hippo. And he, the quote actually is on the first page of the book. And I think it's also on the last page of the book, because it's become everything to me, really. And the quote goes like this: "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." And so I was just looking out at these thousands upon thousands of people, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of restlessness here. How could I demonize or how could I dismiss when I believe that the truest thing about every single person in this field is that they were made by God for God and that they are restless? Like, we were designed to be restless. We are cosmically needy creatures, designed to long for things, designed to yearn for things, designed to ache for things, designed to not want to be the biggest thing in our own lives. I believe that that's true of me. I believe that's true of every single person here. I believe that's true of the thousands of people in the healing field and the billions of people around the world. I just don't think anyone's exempt from that like definition of what a human is, that we were made by God for God and we're restless until we find our rest in him. And so I just started to see the restlessness, really. And I've spent the last couple of years seeing nothing but restlessness and speaking to people who do some of these practices and asking them what their longings are that would drive them there and having these conversations. And I'm just as sure of that now as I was at the healing fields.
So let's go through some of the practices, because that's what you do in the book.
Yeah.
You basically just take one after the other,
yeah,
of the language that people use around God. So when the universe, all, yeah, that sort of stuff. And you talk about auras, and you talk about crystals and all the stuff.
All the stuff.
You go there, yeah, and don't demonize or dismiss any of it.
I try not to. Yeah.
Let's talk about those things, yeah, one after the other. I mean, don't give too much away, because they'll not buy the book if you do. But go.
Yeah, sure. Well, I suppose what I first encountered, the most immediate one, and again, it's because I was at Glastonbury and Dua Lipa was headlining that year, and she got up on stage and she kind of paused things for a moment and she said, "I just want you all to know that I manifested this moment." And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then the same year, Simone Biles, you know, that American gymnast, she won something ridiculous, like 6 gold medals that year. And again, I noticed that in her interview afterwards, it was like, yeah, I did all the training, but I also manifested this success. And I just found it really interesting that people were having these massive moments of success, their dreams coming true before their eyes. And it was their default to be like, yeah, this was kind of me, but also I think this is bigger than me. And so manifesting is the one I always go to first, because it was the one that I wrote about first, because it's so interesting. So this idea, and I'm going to criminally simplify manifest. There are whole books about what this practice is, like whole books on how to do it. And I'm just going to shorten it down into 30 seconds. But basically the premise, let's call it like the core, the foundation of what this is and what people are doing, is it's having something in your mind, be that a dream come true or a kind of success fulfilled, you know, an ambition realized. And you have this in your mind and you visualize it with such sincerity, with such self-love, with such faith in it happening, but also with such like precision and accuracy. So like when you read some of these books that kind of teach you how to do this practice, you have to answer questions to yourself, like, what will it feel like when you achieve this? What will it, who will be around you? What will you know? How will you feel? What will scare, you know? So the level of precision is like really interesting. And so you're doing this and you're doing it with some sort of repetition and fervor, right? So that's one side of it. It's like this idea of, this idea of like visualizing something into its very existence. But if that was all it was, then it wouldn't be a spiritual practice. That would just be mind over matter. Like I do that when I'm trying to parallel park in a tiny space. Like I will visualize myself doing this. And like psychology kind of hits that up and it says, do you know what? You will be more likely to get into that parallel, to get into that tiny space if you tell yourself that you can do it. Like that's actually nothing new. That's just like quite basic psychological mind over matter, clever goal setting, all of that kind of thing. But where it gets, where it becomes a spiritual practice is there's this idea then that it partners with that, that if you do your side of the bargain, the universe, what in the book I call the capital U universe, the capital U universe will respond, will help you out, will add its energy, its force. And so much different language is used. Like I'm just plucking words out, but people have their own lexicons of the language they use for this kind of thing. But it will put its resources into also helping you out. It's rooted in this idea of the law of attraction. So it's like by doing the, by visualizing it with such sincerity and such clarity and such fervor, you're pulling on a mystical lever that the universe will kind of take note of what you're doing, what you're wanting, and then respond and help you with, help that to be actualized. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yep. Yes and no, that makes sense.
Exactly, yep. Right? And so I just found it so interesting that I was like, okay, so people clearly want two things. They want to be in control of their own lives, and they desperately don't want to be in control of their own lives. And they want both of those things at once, right? And so it makes total sense that manifesting has become so popular when you can do everything that you can do. And you can kind of take it into your own hands. So all of you type A people are like, yes, you can be in the driver's seat, but also you are not at the top of the pyramid ultimately. And ultimately, it's this idea that what happens to you, warding off the bad stuff, bringing in the good stuff, there is some help out there somewhere for you. And so it just like, I kind of scratched at it and I just found this longing for people to want to want to make things happen for themselves and desperately don't want to be the only things making them happen. And ergo, manifesting has become so popular. And also I think by Dua Lipa saying, oh, I manifested this moment on the Glastonbury stage, or by Simone Biles saying, I manifested these 6 gold medals. Also what they're doing is they're enhancing that moment with meaning, some kind of cosmic meaning. Like this is bigger than me. It's not just me who's got me here. This is some kind of like huge authored moment that's been authored by something bigger and deeper and truer than me. And it kind of adds this extra weight of meaning, I think, to people's goals being achieved. And so all of that to say, right, I'm a Christian and it's rejection therapy to tell you all that, but I am. And so I happen to believe that we are not supposed to be the authors of our own lives in its entirety. I just happen to believe that I am not strong enough. I am not intelligent enough. I am not omnipotent, right? I cannot make things happen for myself. I cannot make things happen for the people I love. I can't stop bad things happening to them, and I can't make good things happen. Like, I want things for myself and for the people I love that are beyond my own resources to give them, right? Like, I didn't learn to ride a bike till I was 26. It can't all be down to me. It cannot all be down to me, the good stuff. And so I was like, well, who am I to look at someone who manifests their Glastonbury headliner set into being, or manifests passing their driving test, or who am I to look at that and roll my eyes when I have the exact same sacred ache? I go to God. I pray. I don't manifest. I don't do that.
So you definitely think that, because what's sometimes argued is that words like manifest is just it's a new word for an old thing, that the universe is just a different word for God, that manifest is just a different word for prayer. Do you think that's too reductive to just say this is new language for old things?
I think yes and no. I think there's an element. Yeah. So nothing that I write about in the book is recent. Most of it has its roots in centuries old tradition. And because I think of that Augustine quote that we were made by God for God and our hearts are restless until we find that it's rest in him. We've always done this. Yeah. We've always done this. We've never wanted to be in sole control of our own lives. We've always wanted to be in control and always wanted not to be in control. This is just part of what it means to be human. We always will do this.
I was at Greenbelt a few years ago when mindfulness was kind of at its height. And I said to a friend of mine who's a nun, what do you think of all this mindfulness lark? And she went, we've been doing it for centuries, love.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like a bit, you know.
A little bit. Yeah. I would say the key difference though, and I can't, so the book is super gentle. It's basically a come and see invitation. So I take a practice, I unpack it, I dig a bit deeper, I try and work out the longings that would lead anyone to do any of these practices, all of which are becoming way more mainstream, by the way. And then each chapter pivots. Because I kind of put myself on the table and I say, oh, hey, I have that exact same sacred ache. I have that exact same longing. Come and see where I go with it. And it could maybe gets a bit boring because it's just always God, right?
Oh boy. It's not boring.
But it's like, spoiler alert, she's about to talk about God again. Because he's where I go with everything. And I say, and so I guess that's the key difference is around, I don't think that I'm pulling on a something. I think I'm going to a someone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the difference. Whenever I speak to someone who manifests, it's a something. It's a something, some kind of energy, the source, the bigger than me, the capital U universe. It's a something, whereas I'm always going to a someone when I'm going to God. And I think that I would say that's the key difference there. That's the difference between prayer and manifesting. Prayer is relationship. And also, prayer is way more vulnerable in a way, because what do you do when you go to that someone and that someone says no? And you can't just blame it on the fact that you didn't visualize it clearly enough, or, you know, you didn't write it in your notebook enough. You have to grapple with that no and all of the agony that may come from that no. And so I fully understand why manifesting is a less vulnerable, more comfortable place to take that longing. I totally get that.
Let's talk a little bit about comfort then. Which of the kind of spiritual practices that you explore in the book made you the least comfortable?
Oh, what a great question. No one's asked me that. Yeah. I would say manifesting might be up there, because my issue with manifesting, like for myself, I just do not trust myself enough to think that manifesting would be a good idea for me. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've got to have such a trust in your own self to know what will make you happy and what will genuinely be a good thing in your life. You've got to really have like precision on that. And I just have too low of a sense of self for that.
So,
I don't know.
So beyond parallel parking, you think there's something in this manifesting? Do you think there's something in it?
I think there's something in the longing.
Okay.
I'm not sure there's something in the practice itself, I would say.
What made you feel the most comfortable? What was the one that you went, oh yeah, I could pick that practice up right now and just do it?
Oh, oh my gosh, like anything astrology based.
Ooh, let's talk about that.
I could go for anything astrology based.
Really?
If I wasn't a Christian, I could go deep into star signs. And anything, and like tarot as well, like going to a psychic medium.
This is really healing, right, for the post-evangelicals of us, because like a few years ago, we would have gone, right, we need to get out of this tent right now before Satan gets hold of us. So this is kind of like therapy for quite a few of us. Certainly me. Talk to us about tarot then and psychic healing and all that sort of stuff.
Because, tarot,
you know, the 15-year-old me now is dancing around this tent singing Lord Build a Wall or something, you know, and casting out Satan. Yeah. So let's talk about that.
Oh, we can talk a bit about tarot. I was speaking on a podcast recently and someone was like, could you give me a tarot card reading? And I said, I'm not actually like a tarot card reader here. I can't actually do that stuff for you. This is where it gets a bit nerdy, but the earliest deck of cards we have is from the 12th century, I think. We think they're from Milan, and they like a game of top trumps. There's no like folklore or anything attached to them. That came centuries later. It's a really clever card game. That's how it started. And then there started to be this folklore attached to it. And now it's like this unbound book. There's a podcast I listen to, and I know Elizabeth Oldfield is wandering around here. She's the host of The Sacred, and there's an episode of The Sacred with someone who reads tarot, and I learned so much from that episode because of the way, the language that she puts around it. So she says it's like an unbound book, and you're just putting these pages out, and then each card kind of affects what card's going to come next, and it's like a language you need to learn, basically. But those cards, they pay such deep attention to your present that they give you an insight into yourself that you could not get without them. That's the idea.
Right.
So you go to a psychic, and I read a New York Times article recently where the author, McKenna Goodman, was talking about why she's pulled out of going to therapy and starts going to psychics and astrologers instead. Okay. And that's a growing trend in the US. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little sprinkling of that in the UK. And the reason she said she does that is because she said she no longer trusts herself to be the one who tells the story of her own life. So she no longer wants to be the one who puts language to what's going on within her. She no longer trusts herself to be that voice. She doesn't want to be the author.
You started talking about this by saying if you weren't a Christian, you could be really into astrology and tarot. Yeah. So what about your Christianity stopping you then?
Well, I could totally be into it because I get that. I too think that like we need a knowing voice. We need wisdom that is not our own. We need like this external voice to come in and show us parts of ourselves that we wouldn't get to by ourselves. I guess if I get a bit biblical, will your evangelicalness all cringe up there?
Do it.
Well, there's just this part in John. So I've got a doctorate in the Gospel of John, and I just love that book. And Jesus just talks about, he says, "My sheep know my voice, and they budge when they hear it, and they refuse to budge when a stranger calls for them." And so in all the conversations I've had, I've just said that. I've been like, I totally get your need for a knowing voice. The thing is, my knowing voice, I know whose it is. I've learnt what his voice sounds like. I've learnt to move when I hear it, and I'd be really nervous to move when I hear anyone else's voice tell me to budge. So I guess that's kind of the best way I could describe why I wouldn't go to a tarot card reader, because I'm a Christian, because I take that ache elsewhere, and I've learnt what a different knowing voice sounds like, and I've learnt to budge when I hear his.
And you definitely think that the voice of tarot and astrology is not this one and the same voice?
I cannot make like a sweeping statement with that, because some will say that they pray into it and they use tarot as a way of praying, and or tarot as a way of like liaising with God. But there are also definitely people who would say it's just intuition. And again, I don't know if I just have too low of a sense of like, I would never trust my intuition to tell you about you. So I don't know if so much of it comes down to that. So I think maybe, but also maybe not. And so,
because many of us have been in rooms where, you know, I'm presuming here, but, you know, where someone speaks a prophecy, for example, from a Christian faith perspective.
Yes.
And it sounds no different to someone going to see a fortune teller or clairvoyant.
Yeah, you're so right.
You know, and just because it's in a tent at a Christian festival, it's okay. But if that person said it to you in a different context, it's been perceived as not okay for Christians to engage with.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. And actually, people say things in the name of God that are so obviously wildly not him.
Yeah.
So obviously I don't think that doesn't sound like the shepherd's voice either, you know.
Yeah.
So absolutely there is definitely that tension there.
So who's the book for?
So the book would be for anyone I met at the healing fields, basically anyone who calls themselves spiritual but not religious. And I understand why people do, because again, it's way less vulnerable to say you're spiritual than to plant your flag and say I'm religious too. So it'd be for anyone who is disenchanted with disenchantment, who feels that restlessness within themselves and is just wondering what to do with it, who is doing any of those practices, who's doing all of them, who's doing none of them, but they all feel alluring. So it's for those people. It's written to assume that the reader is not a Christian. And I hope that comes across. I hope it doesn't presume anything. But also, I guess it's written for, and I've learned this since it being in the world, it's really written as well for people who maybe would call themselves Christians and are curious about the curiosity that is in the ear. So who want to know how to have these conversations with their friends who are bringing crystals and manifesting and inviting them to all kinds of things, and who want to know, who want to not have a judgy response to that, but want to genuinely understand the deep heartaches that would be leading someone to go and do that. Because it doesn't offer any judgment on it. It just tries to uncover the longings behind all of these super mainstream practices. So I guess it would be
we used to see these as kind of fringe practices, but they are very much mainstream. My mother-in-law's got carers, and one of her carers, she's my mother-in-law's, it sounds like a start of a joke, doesn't it? It's not, it really isn't. She's kind of a mainstream sort of slightly conservative evangelical, and she's got lots of Bible verses around her house and all that sort of stuff. And one of her carers came in and saw her Bible and her prayers and all that sort of stuff and said, I'm spiritual too. Can I, you know, and started sharing some of her beliefs about astrology and stuff. Well, my mother-in-law won't have that carer in the house anymore because that person's, you know, that, but for the carer, she was having the conversation. She thought it was one and the same thing. And you know, it seems to me that there's generations coming through where we don't have so much of defining ourselves by the things we believe and don't believe. It's more of a buffet of faith and spirituality is where we go, oh, well, I'll have a bit of this and I'll have a bit of that and I'll have a bit of
that. Is true. That is happening. Well, I just try to have a really generous curiosity. Just a really generous curiosity. So what because the thing is, right, I think for so long, and I think definitely the people like maybe I grew up with, they would assume I'm the least spiritual person in the room because I'm a Christian.
Right. Oh, that's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah. We've downplayed so much. And I think because we do say, okay, all the spiritual stuff, like the mystical stuff, the stuff we can't explain, like that happens over here. And now we're the logical Christians who like sit over here. And so they have all this spiritual angst within them. They have all of this longing and this craving. And yet Christianity is not a place they've thought to go. That may be changing now, but that was certainly the case when I started writing this book. It's just not a place they've thought of. And so I would just love to change the plausibility structures around that and just say, you have this longing. I have that exact same longing. Come and see where I go with it if you want. You know, so it's just creating those relationships, being relaxed enough and curious enough and generous enough to create those relationships. And then just to have this come and see invitation all the time. And it's got no more pressure on it than that. But if we're not willing to say, if we're not willing to look these people in the eye and really dignify those deep longings within them, if we're going to demonize or dismiss them, we'll never get to that point of relationship where we're able to offer a come and see invitation ever. And nor should we.
I think I'd like to take some questions, if that's all right. Let's do some of that and then we'll chat some more and see where we go with this. So lovely, hands waving. Smashing. Anything we said sparks something in you that you'd like to talk more about, we've got a question for Belle. We've got people on the floor and there's someone right at the back as well. We'll start here. Thank you.
Oh, there you go.
Hi, thank you. Hi. Really interesting stuff. I have a lot of friends who are very much into exactly what you're talking about. And as a Christian, it's a really interesting observation to make between the two parties, for want of a better word. I have quite a lot of crystals because I think they're just beautiful parts of God's creation, and I can have lovely conversations with my friends about that.
Yeah.
I have noticed a turning from the terminology of universe coming back to God, so I can have lots of lovely conversations about that too.
Oh, great.
And I just think it's a really nice correlation, and thank you for writing the book. I'm going to go and buy a copy because I think it's just good, really nice.
That's what we were hoping.
Sort of part of that. My question is, where do we overlap with this? I've been, some of my friends have sort of said to me, well, what happens about the three wise men? They were astrologers. How does that fit into the Bible? Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, you might be able to answer that. But well, how do we branch those two things together and have those lovely kind of conversations?
Yeah. Crystals are beautiful, aren't they? I know. They're like the, yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I do speak about the Magi in the book. We have astrologers in the nativity story. That's probably what they were. We call them kings. We call them wise men. Magi means is most likely, it's the most common use of that word is to mean astrologers, but astrologers who work specifically for the king. So astrologers who were paid to look at the stars, read the stories, and kind of warn the king about what's coming. That's in our Bible. So are Psalms that say things like the heavens declare your glory, or I look to the universe, like what is man that you care for us? That's also in our Bible. And so in right at the end of the Bible, Jesus is called the North Star. So we have we have this within our tradition, this idea that somehow, and I do not have like the know-how as to how this works, but somehow it is not foreign to our Christian tradition that the skies speak. They do speak. They do tell stories. That's mystical beyond my comprehension. I would say what the difference is, as far as I can tell, is the skies never really tend to tell us about us. They all speak about the one who crafted them. And so there's always a point of convergence there. There's always a point of convergence that we get so freaked out about. But the one thing that the skies do tell us about us, a bit like that quote I just gave from David, like, is that how madly loved we are, how deeply and wildly known we are, and by the one that would arrange every single star in the sky and then rearrange them when he fancies it. And maybe that takes an instant, and maybe that takes a million years. I don't know. That's above my pay grade. But how deeply we are known by that same being, by that same God. And so that's a beautiful conversation to get to have with someone. So I've had conversations where I've been like, that's why I'm like, if astrology I could get into. Also, right, listen, there's something weird about a full moon. I know I'm a Christian. A full moon is, there's something weird. Why aren't I sleeping? Because there's a full moon. My sister-in-law is a nurse, and she would just... Yeah.
Police officers are the same.
Yeah, they would just be like, are you kidding? I'm on the night shift and it's
teachers.
A full moon. Yeah, yeah. You're joking.
Full
like,
moon.
There's something's going on, and I'm not afraid to admit that. But that's a beautiful, expansive conversation. And so if we're able to not freak out, not dismiss and not demonize, go to one of those two reactions, there's so much rich beauty to be found in there.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hello. Oh, it's on. Hi. Hi, Val. Thank you. This has been amazing. Also, what you just said, I'm going to think on that one because I hadn't thought about how they weren't pointing towards us beyond, you know, remembering our belovedness, but pointing to God. My question was going to be about, does the book, and I will buy it, but you know, well, I'd ask you whilst I'm here.
I feel like I've got you all under duress.
No, it's fascinating stuff. Does the book go into, I know you mentioned about, you know, Christians who would use tarot or even the lady was speaking before that has crystals. I'm interested in whether your book goes into that kind of crossover from a theological place, not just from like these things are nice and like I'd like to partake, but actually where do you see where the church has maybe dropped the ball, particularly in Western Christianity, as opposed to very early ancient interpretations of Christianity, or not interpretations, but literal iterations of it, right? With the mystics and the first fathers and stuff like that. Does the book touch on actually how we've let go of a lot of this stuff that then has become seemingly secular, and where there's room for us to take it back?
That's a great question. Yeah, it does in various parts. So like there's a section where there's a chapter on yoga, and I say like, I have imbibed this idea that my body is not, that I'm this like spiritual thing in a secular home, and my body is not a spiritual thing. And I'm really honest about the places where the way I grew up or my tradition or my understanding of my spiritual tradition has led me to feel less whole in certain ways. Or, you know, I'm really honest about that all the way through. But then right at the end, I put it right at the end for a reason. I felt I really had to earn the reader's trust before I introduced them to Holy Spirit. And so there's a whole chapter at the end on the Holy Spirit and who he is and what he does. And I really explicit in there, I'm like, listen, we've been terrible at telling you guys about him. And therefore about the mystical, more experiential parts of our faith. And I kind of try and work out what some of the reasons for that are. And I think part of it is because we swim in rationalist waters. And I think it's been a desire of ours to scrub out the parts of our tradition, the parts of our story that feel the weirdest and the least explainable and perhaps the least quote unquote rational. And so we've just done away with them. We've tried to make Christianity like this set of really logical ideas. Like, here's five reasons why the crucifixion definitely happened and why it makes sense, you know, like, because that's what the world has kind of been asking of us. And we've fallen into the trap of pretending that that's all we have to say, and it's not. And so there's a bit of that. There's also a bit of like intellectual snobbery about this stuff. I quote an amazing philosopher who I can't remember the name of, but his book is amazing, and it's called The Art of Losing Control. And he talks about the fact that more charismatic or perhaps more mystical, more supernaturally inclined traditions of Christianity have been seen as for children, the working classes, and women, because they are more emotionally susceptible, emotionally vulnerable. And he just talks about, like, that's not his opinion. He's like, why have Christians done this to themselves? And that's definitely in there as well. So there's like some intellectual snobbery that stops us from talking about Christianity as something that is experiential, because we're just a bit scared of words like that. And then the third thing is that actually it's just really hard to put language to some of this stuff, I think, as well. And I think when we're told what language to use and not to use as well, it's really hard when we feel like our experiences are so much bigger and so much like beyond the language that we've been told, like the four words we've been told we can use to express any one thing. And so I think there's that as well. You know, the theology around it all, we feel like we don't know it well enough to kind of like defend it, and we feel like that's the only posture we can have. And so I think there's a lot of that. There's definitely maybe a sequel that needs to be written, because so many people have asked, like, is it, what about if you have all of it together, and is that okay? And that's not something I touch on, but I definitely touch on the reasons why, like I said a bit earlier, I may just be seen as the least spiritual person in a room because I said I am Christian. Yeah, that was a great question. Thank you for it.
Oh, one here. Let's do that one as we're going past.
Yeah, hi. I'm fascinated to hear about the book, Belle, and I should definitely get it. So I'm ready for conversations as and when they happen. I'm interested to know whether it's a book just for people who want to be able to engage in those conversations. And obviously, I know you want to sell as many copies as possible. But is it a book that you could buy for people who have a sacred ache or may discover a sacred ache, so that they can be exploring these things with your comments?
Yeah. Oh my goodness, yes. It's primarily that. So like, if it's helpful to Christians, that's a beautiful byproduct, if you know what I mean. But yeah, absolutely. If you have people in your life, I promise, and I don't say this lightly, but like I tread gently. I promise I do in this book. It's a book that you can give to people. And I promise I hold every single reader with such tenderness. I think I actually say in the intro to the book, like, I come to you with curiosity and with tenderness, I promise. And I will, for as long as they let my voice be in their mind, I'm honored to be in there. And there's no quick fixes or judgment or anything like that. So it is primarily that. Yeah,
and your aim of this book is not to persuade those people not to engage with tarot or astrology or crystals.
It's just a come and see invitation. It's just a come and try this. Come and try prayer. Come and try, you know, all of the things, all of the counterparts, because I was able to find a Christian counterpart to every single
And you absolutely believe they are counterparts rather than one and the same thing with just a new label, do you think? Or am I pushing you too hard? Don't know.
I don't know. A case-by-case basis, we'll take that.
Okay.
Another question.
So you said that you thought the main difference between the way... So the way you view God is that he's a person, yeah, and manifestation is more like kind of speaking into the universe. My question, I guess, is what if people are viewing the universe as a being, but much more expansive and multifaceted than just a someone, which they might have had a story told about. For example, they might view the word God as some patriarchal authority,
yeah,
or they might have been harmed by that term in lots, yeah, of different contexts by going to different within religion, or it, you know, there's a lot attached to the word God. And maybe is it possible that people who are exploring spirituality more generally, and maybe taking bits from here, there, and everywhere, because they want to get to know God more fully and actually outside of that trauma that they might have experienced, that obviously it's a big topic and language is so powerful and so personal. So could it be that people, when, like, for example, I might say I'm manifesting something, or I'm talking to source or the universe or ultimate, yeah, reality or God, or there's so many different words.
Higher power for those people, AA and all that sort of
higher
stuff.
Higher power. But to, yeah, that person, that really does mean a being, but a being that is so much more than you can, which we can't describe God. And even yeah, the Bible,
yeah,
uses lots of different words for God, like, yeah, Elohim, which is plural, you know, the host of heavens. And then you've got, you know, obviously Jesus, you've got the Trinity. Mm-hmm. So just wondered, yeah, what you had to say about that. Thanks.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I think that the word... Cool. Can you find a more loaded word than the word God, do you think? I don't know if I can think of one. You're right. It carries multitudes within it. Multitudes within it. And I speak, actually, I've got a whole chapter on witchcraft in there. But witchcraft as a feminist identity, like as a female phenomenon that seems to be catching on at the moment. And in it, I talk about like pronouns for God and all of this kind of thing. I talk about Julian of Norwich, who calls God and Jesus her mother and uses she pronouns for God and all of that kind of thing. And I absolutely agree that God, was it Ian McGilchrist, the psychologist? He was like, I wish we had a word that wasn't a word. Like, I wish we had a word for him or for what people are talking about that had no letters to it. Because how do you put letters to this kind of thing? And so I definitely, definitely think that you've got an excellent point and that you're really drawing beautiful attention to a whole subset of people that I've spoken to, who the word God is just too much, way too much. And actually this idea of like planting a flag in the ground of anyone's story is too much right now, but they still feel that restlessness that I keep yapping on about, and they still feel that ache. So I think you're absolutely, absolutely right. And in the book, I kind of touch upon some of that. And I kind of agree, like, when we talk about these things, language runs out. And then as someone who works in language, that's really frustrating. Again, I say in the book, like, I have written this paragraph 7 times because the language just isn't even getting close. And so, yeah, I think you are totally right to acknowledge that that is something that's happening, and that it's happening for really tender, vulnerable reasons. That I'm really aware. I'm really, really, really aware. Whenever I have a conversation like this, whenever I hear that the book has been given to someone, I could not be more aware that we are talking about things that are the deepest longings that a person can hold. And sometimes the deepest hurts that a person is holding and the deepest fears. And so to treat that with the utmost care and the utmost respect and the utmost tenderness is like paramount in all of these conversations. When language, it's like we're not allowed to be flippant with our language when we're talking about something this deep. We're just not allowed. And so I think you make a great point. Yeah, thanks for sharing it.
Wonderful.
Thank you for sharing your own experience. Really appreciate it, especially with your own perspective of like your trust of your own mind or what you think is right, and search it, like listening for God's advice is something really important to you. But I think from my perspective, I sort of almost experienced it the other way around, where in my experience, I've been surrounded by people that say, God is saying this to me, or God's telling us we need to do that. And actually, it's been quite harmful. And interestingly, I know people that are now searching or like going through different spiritual practices. So I know someone that's been speaking with an astrologer a lot, but some of the stuff that we've seen them recommending has been quite harmful for them, actually. It's actually done quite a lot of harm. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering how you would address that, you know, that kind of knowledge of whether you can actually trust like something that might seem like it's coming from God, or how you might advise people that are experiencing these different spiritual practices that might actually lead them down a not very healthy path, and when it's actually maybe good to actually think and try to trust your own instincts a bit and think, actually, what do I think is right? It'd just be really interesting to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, gosh, that's a great question. I think I'd want to answer it in two ways, if I may. The first one is that I too have been in rooms where someone has said something and said, God is saying this, and it's been really harmful. And I think just a baseline, and there's so much more to say about this, but just a baseline is, if it doesn't drip with love and ooze grace, I think we can just push that aside and assume that's got a lot more human in it than it has God in it. But when processing any of that, when processing that stuff, I just think community as well, trusted community, always, always trusted community. And I think that would be across the board with everything, trusted community, telling people what you're trying, telling people why you're trying it, telling people what you want to get out of it, what you're longing for, what you're scared of, trusted people that can hold you in that process, I think is absolutely paramount. Community is always paramount. I think if you take that out of anything, you're in dangerous ground. If you're doing all of this kind of solo, and the only voice you're having is that of either the person you're paying or the person who's on the stage, and you're not finding other voices that know you deeply and love you relentlessly to thrash that out with, that's dangerous across the board. The other thing I do say in the book, and this could go for Christians as well with prayer, right? The other thing I do say in the book is, if any spiritual practice is just always gratifying you, be weary of it, I think. Because I sometimes think that that's just our consumerism just being channeled in a different way. And so I do think that if you're going to something because you need instant gratification, and it kind of feels like you're just getting the next hit again and again and again and again, just pause for a moment. Just pause for a moment and just like ask yourself if this is actually good for you, or if this is like your consumerism that maybe was channeled one way and is now channeling another way. Because I just think that that can be as damaging to us as well, right? And we start to get addicted to this kind of stuff, and we're not immune to that when we're Christians, as if I always go to God with good intentions. Like, that's I'm not immune to that either. But this sense of needing a next hit of something, and it promising instant gratification, and if it's not giving you instant gratification, then we'll just come again, because next time it will give you instant gratification. Whatever your spiritual practice is, that feels dangerous to me. Part of having a faith is grappling with tensions and with no's and with gray areas and with waiting and with hardship and all of this kind of thing. So I would say those are just a few tips. There are so many more, but that's a really beautiful question you've asked. Thank you.
And I'm afraid that is our last question. We've run out of time, sadly. But the good news is that Bella is going to be across in the bookshop signing books.
Come see me.
And the best way to ask that question, if you've still got it burning, is go and buy a book, get in the queue, and ask it when you get to the front of the queue.
You can ask it for free as
well.
Yeah,
you can ask it for free. You want to go. Very quickly, yeah. What's your hope for this book?
Oh, I mean, my hope is to have more conversations like this.
Right.
But just like sometimes there'll be thousands of us and sometimes there'll just be twos and threes. But my hope is that conversations feel more curious. They feel more generous. They feel like we're taking care of each other's souls in them. And then that people just come and see, basically.
The Sacred Ache by Bell Tyndall Riley is out now and is available at Bookshop. Would you please join me in thanking Bell for her time?
End of the day, and it's been a long, wet one. Thank you so much for joining us here in Pagoda, and please put your hands together one last time for Kate and Belle.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.